Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Presidential elections in Tunisia are just around the corner, but one of the three candidates remains in jail. We'll get analysis.
He has been reaching out. He's been calling on his supporters to continue the campaign for him. But it's all been very muted. There's not really been much evidence that there's an election happening. Honestly, if you weren't actively seeking news about the election, you wouldn't really be aware that anything was happening.
And the state of the nation in Zimbabwe, as the country battles a biting drought and a struggling local currency. It's Thursday, the 3rd of October. We begin in Kenya. Members of Parliament in Nairobi have started the process to remove the country's deputy president from office. Rigathi Gachagua ran as President William Ruto's running mate and won the election just over 2 years ago. He is now being accused of undermining the president, bullying government officials, and promoting ethnically divisive politics. His allies have been accused of having a role in June's anti-government demonstrations, which turned deadly. Mr. Gachagua has denied these claims and defended himself as being a truthful man who's not afraid to speak truth to power. Let's listen to the Speaker of Kenya's National Assembly, Moses Wetangula, receiving the impeachment motion.
Honourable members, pursuant to Article 151B of the Constitution, and Standing Orders 64 and 65, I wish to notify the House that I am in receipt of a notice of a special motion dated Thursday, 26 September 2024, and received on Friday, 27 September 2024, from the Member for Kibwezi West, the Honourable Ecomas Mwengi Mutuse MP. The Honourable Member seeks a resolution of the House for the removal from office by impeachment of His Excellency Rigathi Gachagua, EGH, as the Deputy President of the Republic of Kenya. Okay. Honourable members.
Now, according to the Kenyan media, Mr. Gachagua filed a petition in court today seeking to halt the process launched against him. For more on this, I've been speaking to Kenyan political analyst Stella Agara, who's based right here in Nairobi.
The Kenyan deputy president is a gentleman called Geoffrey Rigathi Gachagua, and he was granted a nickname, Rigiji. He's a Kenyan politician who has been serving the government for a very long time. He's a career public servant, has been within the provincial administration of the country, and in the last election, he was requested by the current president to be his running. He has been serving for the last 3 years, and not necessarily as an accepted deputy president, but as the person who took this seat. He's now under siege because he has been at odds with the president for some time. There are certain things they have not agreed on between him and the president. And of course, the moment when the president is out for UNGA in New York has of course served as a politically prudent time for them to make the onslaught against him and try to get him out of office. Whether they'll succeed or not is something that we are yet to see.
So what is it about Rigathi Gachagua's politics that really made him deputy president? Because in Kenya, the system, the way the constitution is, it's a joint ticket. The president has a running mate. So what is it about his politics that made him the man for the job?
Because politics in Africa generally is controlled by money, the biggest thing that made him deputy president is the fact that he had the resources to invest in the campaign. They were both in the opposition at the time, and that meant that they needed to master resources to engage in the campaigns. Number two is the fact that he would be a candidate who would be attractive to the voters from the central part of Kenya who happened to vote as a bloc. And so in terms of negotiation, if you get the central part of Kenya to vote for you as a bloc, you get quite a huge number of votes. They are counted as, I think, the second largest number of voters in the country. And so it did help his negotiations that he was coming from that region. He also happens to be quite experienced in politics, and they may have been with the president in the same political party when the president was actually still a novice in KANU, the second ruling party in Kenya.
Yeah, so talk to us about why he is being impeached now. What are the allegations that are being leveled against him?
A number of allegations have been documented. I mean, some of them maybe not impeachable offenses, but ideally they have mentioned issues of integrity. They have mentioned issues of exposing or disclosing government secrets. They have talked about the fact that he is not serving the president as he should. And the deputy president in Kenya is normally a running mate, and eventually he gets voted in. He's supposed to be assisting and supporting the president in the business of running the nation. So there are people who feel that maybe he has not served that role as he should. And then, of course, a number of them have brought up a lot of corruption and bargaining issues and bribery issues. I mean, it's a raft of accusations, hopefully some of which that all together will be able to get them to impeach the president. He has tried to stop this process. Unfortunately, the courts refused to stop the process of impeaching him. And I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday when the speaker accepted a motion to impeach the president. And of course, the process is currently underway, which will, of course, involve a number of processes, including the engagement of citizens in public participation for the next couple of days to establish whether they support the agenda of impeaching the president. And then, of course, they are planning to sit on Tuesday next week, first of all, to consider the feedback from the public participation process, and in the afternoon to actually start discussing the motion to impeach the deputy president.
Okay, so we will go a bit more in detail about how the process looks like, you know, if you could define that. But before that, what is the deputy president then saying about this impeachment? Because he's not been in power for a very long time. Him and President Ruto and the entire government have only been in power for about 2 years. So what does he have to say about what's going on now and these allegations that are being leveled against him?
I think one of the first things we observed is that on the day when the president was leaving to travel to New York for UNGA, he actually had scheduled an interview with a media station, which was widely watched by Kenyans. And in this interview, he was busy explaining what he has done in the last couple of years when he was deputy president. He indicated how he has supported the president. He indicated how many subcommittees of the cabinet that he has convened, the assignments that the president gave him that he implemented successfully. And then, of course, he indicated the areas where he believes he was not consulted and therefore he cannot be able to respond on behalf of government. The sense I got out of that interview is that he knew that this impeachment was coming. And so he was anticipating their actions by ensuring that he communicates to Kenyans that he is innocent, that he has served the president the way he should have, and he continues to be loyal to the president. And the last thing he did was to implore the president to ask his people or his team not to, one, embarrass his deputy president, but number two, to interfere with their plan of delivering to Kenyans. And he says they have a long list of things that they need to do in order to achieve the manifesto they had committed to Kenyans. So he was imploring the president to actually focus on those and avoid this political drama that is now arising. He's obviously also saying that in the event that they strong arm him and push him out, he's also capable of mobilizing his supporters in parliament to also institute an impeachment motion against the president. Of course, that is going to be extremely messy in terms of the political survival of their party, which is the United Democratic Alliance. Yeah. He has also expressed regret in terms of the decisions he made of joining the United Democratic Alliance instead of coming in with his political party and then being a part of the coalition, which means he has a political party that he can move out with. Right now, if this impeachment is successful, it basically means he's out and he's going to be an orphan until he finds another political home to occupy.
So Stella, then what is the process of impeaching a deputy president, and is it something that is rooted in the Kenyan constitution? If you could explain that to us.
So the process of impeachment is something that is rooted in the Kenyan constitution. And the Kenyan constitution makes provisions for how the office of the president could fall vacant and the grounds upon which that would happen, which are mostly natural means, like, for example, the death of the president or incapacitation of the president, which could arise due to many reasons that are listed, including insanity or, you know, that kind of thing. And then it also makes provision for a process where people are not confident in the leadership of the president or his deputy, and therefore they now decide to bring a motion to impeach either of them. And so this, of course, is a question that has been in the public for some time, because Kenyans have been asking, is it possible to impeach the deputy president and leave his president when the nature of that office is such that he deputizes his president? And so most of the things he does on behalf of the president. So
in law then, Stella, is it actually possible to do it? And does the, what I'm trying to find out is whether this has any basis in the law of the land. And if so, then what is the process? What are we going to see in the next few weeks or months?
I think after the court case and after the attempts by the deputy president to stop the process of impeaching him through the court, we have published that it is indeed possible to institute an impeachment motion against him. The law recognizes that there are two individuals, and even in his deputization, it does not necessarily mean that everything he's doing is instructed by the president, and it recognizes that there's a possibility that there are certain excesses that could be linked to the president on his own or linked to the deputy president on his own. And I believe this is why the court upheld the process, at least, and allowed the process to proceed. There are people who have the feeling that there's a possibility that the judiciary is feeling intimidated and therefore could not stop the process. But I am confident that the judiciary could have stretched their muscles or at least put their foot down if that kind of a situation existed. So at least it is allowed. Number two, The issues that are going to be raised against him need to be issues that are leveled strictly against him. If some of those issues eventually leveled against him are touching on the president or assignments he's been given by the president, then of course he's going to raise a few questions, and maybe he may even have an opportunity to go back and challenge this in court. The way the provisions of the law have been set is such that this process must be done through the National Assembly. The representatives of the people are the ones who must carry the day, and every single step of it must be subjected to public participation, so that then this particular process of impeachment is safeguarded from being a witch hunt or prevented from being used by political opponents to just settle scores. That is why you would have noted, if you have seen the process that is intended, you would have noted that there are very many steps that have been put in place, and a number of them are just checks and balances and ensure that in the end, if this decision is reached, it is a decision that every Kenyan wants to see taking place.
So people wonder, or one wonders, who has the deputy president fallen out with? What is leading to this?
I think there are a number of people who the deputy president has fallen out with. Number one, he has fallen out with his own boss, the president. There are certain things that they don't agree on. And unfortunately, the way those things have played out, I think, has definitely shown that they are going to continue being at odds with this president. And that is why you can see that it's mostly the president's camp that is fighting him. The second group of people he's fallen out with is some of the leadership from his region, who feel that there are certain things that they're competing over. And a lot of it has to do with resources. In a sense, we should be saying that he's eating more than the rest of them are eating. And so some of them feel like they're entitled to also take up the position that he's holding and lead their community in the political arena.
Doesn't he have security of tenure?
Ideally, he should have security of tenure. The way the constitution works is that he and the president serve for the entire term. In the event that something happens and that the president's seat falls vacant, he is supposed to continue for the remainder of the term, according to the constitution. So ideally, the constitution has built in security of tenure, but in the event that he then is found to have committed offenses that then warrant impeachment or removal from office, then the opportunity for impeachment and recall provided for. And that is, I think, the situation he finds himself in right now.
What does this all mean for politics in Kenya? Because we saw very massive anti-government protests not long ago.
Indeed, this is very destabilizing for the politics in Kenya. The fact that he has also promised that if he's removed from office, he's also going to lead his team into putting in place an impeachment motion against the president means that then this government is going to be focusing heavily on survival and not necessarily delivering for Kenyans. There are a raft of proposals that were made by the Gen Z and the Kenyans who were out protesting that need to be put in place in order to resolve the issues that brought them to the streets that haven't been implemented. And so this is going to cause this to lag behind. We are also very aware as Kenyans that sometimes this kind of drama is put in place to cover up important things. And there are two critical corruption issues and one developmental issue concerning health that Kenyans have been adamant about for the last couple of days. And so Kenyans also know that this could just be, you know, drama to divert their attention from the issue of the sale of our airport and that another issue concerning health insurance that Kenyans have been very, very vocal about in the last couple of days. And so maybe this could be a smokescreen to make sure that the conversation on those two and then Kenyans pay attention to this thing and then eventually it will all be gone.
All right. Thank you very much, Stella, for your time. Stella Agara, a governance and youth development specialist in Kenya. Next to Tunisia, where presidential elections are due to take place at the weekend on Sunday, 6th October. The incumbent, President Kais Saied, who is standing again, was democratically elected in 2019. However, he then began tightening his grip on power. He dissolved parliament and began to rule by decree in 2021. Only two candidates are standing against Mr. Saied in the election, and one of those, Ayachi Zamel, has been sentenced to 12 years in prison just this week on charges of document falsification. A number of others are also behind bars, but weren't even cleared to face the incumbent at the ballot. You may recall that Tunisia was the birthplace of the Arab Spring or the Jasmine Revolution in 2011. Over a decade later, people are still struggling with the cost of living crisis, which has affected people all over the world. It's a talking point as people go to the polls, as we've been hearing from ordinary people at a market in Tunis.
We cannot meet our needs. Our salaries are always decreasing. Even if I save, whenever any problem happens, that money will be gone. This is how our life is, and there is nothing we can do. The only thing is that we are living now, and the future will take care of itself. Hopefully, God will bring something better.
It's true that we lack many essential things like oil and semolina. But honestly, President Kais Saied is making an effort and doing a lot. But to be honest, there are the paid lobbies causing problems from abroad. Yes, there is high inflation and we can't always find oil or sugar at the market. But to endure, we have to be patient.
The rising prices have become unbearable and the citizen is really suffering. 100,000 is no longer enough. Then 200,000 is no longer enough. Then 300,000 is no longer enough. Not to mention the needs of the children, school expenses, electricity, water, and rent.
Besides the economic crisis, President Saied has been accused of silencing his critics in the run-up to the polls. Elysia Volkman is a journalist normally based in Tunisia, but joined me from our London studios to tell me more about this election.
Realistically, there are actually only two candidates, because Zamel is unfortunately languishing in prison. This is a very unusual election, and we highly expect President Kais Saied, the incumbent, who was democratically elected in 2019, to be the outright winner again. The other candidate is from the National Party, who have been very supportive of Saied and his agenda, and they supported him throughout the referendum to change the constitution from a hybrid parliamentary and presidential system to a purely presidential system, but more than that, one where all of the three major powers, executive, judicial and legislative, are gathered in the hands of one man, meaning the president.
So if there's a candidate that once supported the president, what then are they campaigning on? And are they a real threat?
I wouldn't say that they're a real threat. I mean, the impression that the press see is that this other candidate is, in a way, a supporting act to give validity to the elections. Because if Saied was the only candidate, that would be quite obviously, you know, a dictatorial, authoritarian regime. The National Party are presenting a program, and they've been saying that, you know, only real change can be sought through the ballot box. And certainly behind the scenes, there are a lot of doubts about Said's ability to continue to govern, because he's been very chaotic. He's had a sort of constant change of government. So there are always ambitions of that party, but none of the other candidates that have been put forward in as the final three, apart from Kais Said, are well-known politicians. They're very much minor figures who the public don't know.
So how has the campaign then been looking like? Because you mentioned one of those candidates, Ayachi Zamel, is actually in jail.
Yes. He has been reaching out. He's been calling on his supporters to continue the campaign for him. But it's all been very muted. There's not really been much evidence that there's an election happening. The Ashab candidate, he has been going out into the regions. He started out in the northwest in Gasserine, which is a very deprived area, and he's been campaigning. And he's been fairly sort of outspoken about the policies, but at the same time not directly challenging the president, except for a call for a TV debate, which wasn't planned. Up till now, since the revolution, there's always been some kind of public debate, and certainly there have been really big events. In fact, the public debate on television between Kais Said and the man who came second, Nabil Karoui, it was mass viewing everywhere. It was on in cafes, it was projected in the streets. It was, there was some razzmatazz around it, and there was a real buzz, but there's been none of that. It's very flat, it's muted. Honestly, if you weren't actively seeking news about the election, you wouldn't really be aware that anything was happening.
You said it's almost as if there is no election coming up, which is quite unusual to see in a country, especially in Africa. Are people in Tunisia really interested in this election, and what does it say about the participation and the voter turnout?
It will be really interesting to see what the turnout actually is this time. The last two ballots were very poorly attended. Both the referendum and the parliamentary elections, the final turnout figures were 11%, though there were observers who said that the turnout was as little as 8%. At the parliamentary elections, Said said that, you know, this just shows that people aren't interested in parliamentary politics. But I think it's more that people are generally really quite disheartened with politics in general. They feel that voting and participating doesn't change anything, and they're sort of sick and tired of the political class right across the board. So it's more a reflection of a sense of hopelessness and despair. I mean, people are deeply unhappy, but at the moment, because the political characters who were sort of leading Tunisian politics before have either decamped and sought political asylum outside of Tunisia, or they've been arrested, or they've just retreated into the wings. There's no alternative to Said.
So if the people are sort of disinterested in the election, then I wonder what that says about the incumbent, President Said. How popular is he now? Because he was quite popular when he was first elected.
Certainly his popularity has waned. However, there is definitely a diehard cohort of Said enthusiasts and zealots. Oddly enough, there's a sort of cult of personality around him. But it's because he represents quite a lot of the people. I mean, he's not from abject poverty, but he's somebody who's come from a rural background, who's made good, who's gone to university, who ended up teaching at university. He's also, you know, on his shoulders, he sort of bears all the grudges and annoyances that other people feel. And he has, throughout his career, voiced sort of an isolationist, hyper-nationalist agenda, which for people who are really kind of beaten down and struggling to make ends meet and have lived through two dictators who were deeply nationalist and isolationist. He strikes the right notes, things that are familiar, that, you know, Tunisia is being controlled by foreign powers. I mean, he's even come out with sort of extreme conspiracy theories. I mean, this, you know, he did in February 2023 when he said that Tunisia was being flooded with hordes of migrants who are intent on changing the demographic of Tunisia, and more recently saying that the Freemasons are trying to infiltrate and control Tunisia. And these are conspiracy theories that people are reading on the internet and soaking up and just eating up with a spoon, because it's explaining their misery away.
Thank you, Alizia. We shall be watching this election. Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
That's the journalist Alizia Volkman. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa delivered his second State of the Nation address yesterday since his re-election in August last year. This address comes amid soaring inflation, worsening living conditions, and crumbling social services. Critics say the speech offered no concrete path forward, adding it was a disheartening address devoid of practical solutions for Zimbabwe's current challenges. The president vowed to implement corrective measures to protect people's incomes after the country's new gold-backed currency, known as the ZiG, and short for Zimbabwe Gold, slid on the black market only 5 months after it was introduced. It was devalued by 43% just last week. I've been speaking to the BBC's Shingai Nyoka in Harare. So how did it go and what were the highlights?
Well, it was quite a wide-ranging address that lasted just over 30 minutes. The main issue that he talked about from the onset was about the impact of drought, which he says had affected all economic sectors, and then spoke about the measures that the government is putting in place to address the effects of drought. So, for example, they're giving out grain as well as cash to people in the urban areas. Also, the school feeding programs for all learners in communities hard hit by the drought, and the agro shops to assure that there's food availability at affordable prices in specific communities. But he was also optimistic about the coming season and said that the government has been able to fund the wheat production at record levels in the coming months, but that they also expect that there'll be a turnaround in the agricultural sector because of the expected normal to above normal rainfall. But the major issue that he also talked about was the one of the currency. In the last couple of days, the currency had crashed by about 44%, devalued by the central bank. And he said that the currency had enough backing in terms of gold reserves as well as the metals that are in reserve, and blamed the currency crash on the speculators, currency speculators, which is essentially the black market. And he said that the government is going to take measures against the illegal currency dealers. But then he also spoke about the other aspects. You know, the government wants to create jobs, about the importance of the mining sector, but also the fact that he expects Parliament to expedite several bills, including the death penalty abolition bill, and then another controversial bill which had been amended, the private voluntary organizations, which seeks to control the operations of non-governmental organizations.
In countries like South Africa or even the US, State of the Nation addresses are such a big deal. In the country of Zimbabwe, is it such a big deal?
Not at all. And it hasn't been for many, many years. In fact, since the former president, Robert Mugabe, was in power, I think people just really lost the confidence that they had in the government and its ability to address some of their issues. And I think what's also contributed to the loss of interest is in the past, there was a lot of pomp and fanfare through central Harare, and people would gather opposite the parliament and they would watch the guard of honor, the flypast, and the soldiers mounted on horseback. But now that it's held at a new parliament, the Chinese built a new parliament outside of town. It's just really isolated people. But I think it just really speaks to the fact that people don't really have a lot of confidence in what the president has to say and whether his address will actually address the problems that they have.
Let's pick on one of the issues that you talked about, which is the currency. And now saying that, you know, the people may not have the confidence in the president and his speech. What about in his ability to address the economic issues that are in Zimbabwe right now, specifically with the ZiG, which is the currency?
I think just to put it into perspective, the Zimbabwe gold or the ZiG is the sixth currency that this country has had, the sixth local currency that this country has had in about 25 years. So there really isn't anything new apart from the fact that when the government introduced it just last April, they said that it would not fail, that it was backed by gold, it was backed by the metal reserves, and that they were also going to build up reserves in foreign currency. And so, you know, for the last 5 or so months, it had been relatively stable. But that was because that the government essentially had fixed the exchange rate of this currency against the US dollar. And meanwhile, on the black market, which is where a lot of people trade their foreign currency and which exchange rate a lot of people use, especially your companies, they use that to price their goods. The rate had halved almost. And so when the central bank decided to devalue this currency, they essentially tried to bring it in line with the black market exchange rate, which a lot of people believe is just the actual value of the currency. And so what people are seeing now is that, you know, the money that they had in their accounts, the local money that they had, essentially lost 44% of its value overnight. And so that's where the lack of confidence comes from, is the fact that this is something that has happened over and over again with the previous currencies. And there really is no trust in the government's ability to be able to provide a stable currency.
This black market, how does it really operate and how does it affect or confuse the whole agenda of what the government is trying to do?
You know, trying to explain how this economy operates is really difficult, even though for many Zimbabweans, it's something that they have lived with for a good 20 or so years. But essentially, what drives the black market is essentially the lack of US dollars. There are multiple currencies that are legal tender here. So, you know, you can go into your supermarket with the US dollar, with the South African rand, or the local currency and use that interchangeably. But because the Zimbabwe dollar has lost value rapidly and people really don't trust it, they prefer to keep their money in US dollars. And so people that earn in local currency, as soon as they have that money in their hands, they tend to rush to the black markets to exchange for the US dollar. And so that really is essentially what's driving the devaluation of the local currency against the US dollar. But, you know, I think 90% of transactions in this country are conducted in US dollars. But what happens with that 10% is that people really don't want to hold on to that local currency, and which really kind of drives the pressure. And so it's not the central bank that's determining the value of the local currency. It's the black market where businesses go to change their local currency so that they can buy goods and import them, and where people also want to get that money and to maintain the value.
And the president now promises to crack down on this market. Can he do that?
Well, he's done that before. In fact, in May, soon after the introduction of the ZiG, there was a huge blitz. Hundreds of money changers in Harare, outside of the capital, as well as in the second city of Bulawayo, were rounded up, held without bail. Some of them pleaded guilty and paid their fines. Bank accounts were frozen for violating exchange controls. And so at the time, there was a little bit of fear, and that decreased the activity in terms of illegal foreign currency exchange. But it's resumed again. And this is something that has happened over and over again. It's not the first time that there's been a threat to clamp down on illegal money changers. Even in the previous government under Robert Mugabe, the same was done. But it always seems to bounce back because essentially they're speaking to the demand that exists. So, you know, he might try to arrest them, but they're just some fundamentals that the government needs to put in place. Economists say that they should just do away with the local currency and just use the US dollar, or allow the local currency to float, the exchange rate to float, without trying to fix it as they have in the past and prior to this devaluation.
Help us understand the decisions of the central bank in the recent past. Why did they introduce the ZiG in the first place in April?
Well, it was done to replace the Zimbabwe dollar, which was the fifth currency that was introduced in the last, if I recall correctly, six or so years. And essentially what the government has said is that this country cannot rely on just the US dollar. They just don't have the level of control over the economy when you're using a foreign currency where the policies are determined elsewhere. And so this really was an attempt to try to introduce a local currency backed by gold, which they believed wouldn't really lose the value because the previous currency was really not backed on anything apart from confidence. But, you know, there are questions now about whether this currency is backed by gold, because the gold prices have been rising, which means that the currency should be getting stronger, but that's not happening. And so the government is just really trying to introduce a currency that the citizens will feel comfortable with. And it seems as if they're losing that battle, because that's not happening, even with this currency that they said was unsinkable.
And with the devaluation now, I mean, 44% is a huge amount for a currency to just lose its value like that. What is the impact of this on daily life?
The impact, I think, is just there was a bit of a shock value initially, because as you say, you know, this currency didn't lose value over 5 months. It literally lost value overnight. And so if you had 100 local dollars in your account, essentially they'd lost 44%. And so there were some reports of panic buying in some shops. And I think the reactions that we see from Zimbabweans are just, it's a reaction to the past trauma where savings are wiped out. And so it's, you know, it's almost like a dog chasing its tail that the government introduces these new measures, but there's really very little that they can do at this stage to help Zimbabweans build confidence in their measures.
The BBC's Shingai Nyoka. And that's Focus on Africa today. It was produced by Rob Wilson and Benjamin Woodruff in London. And Franny Joey was in Nairobi. Connie Sharp was a senior journalist in charge, and Jonathan Greer was a technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again soon.
The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines, exploring the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world.
Politics.
Civil society.
Products and services.
AI.
Each week we ask one big question.
Can Germany's far right win the country?
And go in search of answers with the help of four expert witnesses.
Is Turkey getting more dangerous for women?
The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts. The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines, exploring the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world.
Politics.
Civil society.
Products and services.
AI.
Each week we ask one big question.
Can Germany's far right win the country?
And go in search of answers with the help of four expert witnesses.
Is Turkey getting more dangerous for women?
The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.